All was very quiet in the DeRose household. I was just a little boy at the time, 8 or 10 years old, and when I was sure that everyone was asleep, I quietly slipped out of my bed. I made my way across my bedroom and then out into the hall. Down the stairs I went, for I was headed to a very special place in the DeRose household, the kitchen. For you see, in the kitchen of our home was a large metal canister. And so it was that night, walking finally to the kitchen, I spied the prize. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever dealt with a metal cookie jar. But if you want to get into a metal cookie jar carefully, you have to be very, very careful. And so I carefully took the lid off the cookie jar, reached inside. David, what are you doing in the cookie jar? It was Mom. Now, some of you ladies know how moms do it. But my mom had caught me in the cookie jar. And she gave me a message that went something like this. David, don't you know eating cookies in the middle of the night is not good for you? I didn't realize it at the time, but a connection was developing in my brain. Tastes good, bad for me. Now, in that very same DeRose household, I had two parents that loved me very much. They actually still do. They're still alive. And as a young man, they wanted me to grow up strong and healthy. And so they had this habit of sometimes putting things on the dinner table that were green. Some of you might be able to relate to this. Green leafy vegetables. And I'm saying that with some of the enthusiasm that I had as a young person. Because right now, I actually love green leafy vegetables. You know, if you cook up some collard greens or kale or mustard greens, I mean, I'll have extra servings if you give me the chance. But then, as a kid, I mean, I was doing... I mean, really good just to kind of be playing with my green leafy vegetables. But sooner or later, my dad, he would turn to me and he'd say something like this. David, eat those greens. They're good for you. Again, I didn't realize it. But there was another connection developing in my brain. Tastes bad, good for me. I can see some nods of recognition as I speak to you about this, because I find as I speak to audiences, they often have the very same background that I do, at least in terms of what they think of when they think about healthy behaviors. You see, it's almost like we have two compartments in our brain. You know, one compartment is something that we label healthy. And along with healthy choices often come adjectives like dull and boring. Are you with me here? And maybe that's putting it mildly. On the other side of our brains, though, we have another compartment. And in that compartment, we have the things that are unhealthy. And what kind of adjectives do we often use to speak about unhealthy behaviors? Fun, enjoyable. I mean, think about the advertising we have today. I mean, you go into a store, you'll see things like sinfully delicious, decadently rich. I mean, have you seen those things? And so it's somehow like if something is healthy, it's somehow that would be unenjoyable. And so it is over the years as I've had patients. Many of them have said things like, well, you know, doc, I got to do something to have fun. You know, I can't be so healthy. I'm already healthy enough. Well, let me ask you a question. Even though a lot of us have had this background, this learning that has made us oftentimes look at the world either in the healthy, boring things or the unhealthy, life-giving, zest-giving items, is it really true? Do you have to somehow choose between being healthy and being happy? You ever thought about the question? Well, researchers have actually looked at this. So whether you've ever wondered about it or not, medical researchers are very interested in this. You see, medical researchers don't just look at the things that may seem to be very important, like how to prevent heart disease and cancer and the latest treatments. But many researchers are interested in quality of life. I mean, this is a real interest that people have today. And so quality of life research is really a very growing area in the medical community and the medical research community. Right here in the state of California, many years ago, a study was almost never begun. You say, well, I'm sure a lot of studies were never begun. How can a study be almost never begun? Well, I never knew the story about this very famous study until some years ago. I was a speaker at the National Wellness Conference at the University of Wisconsin, and there was another speaker there. His name was Dr. Lester Breslow. Any of you ever heard the name of Dr. Lester Breslow? Okay, a few hands, a few nods of recognition. Dr. Breslow was once the director of the California State Department of Health. This was back in the 50s. And Breslow had this idea. Now, this you got to put this in the time frame here. I know some of you weren't even born in the 50s. But in the 50s, people thought that we were going to cure all kinds of diseases by medical science. You see, our focus was on science and medicine and antibiotics and the latest cures. Not too many people were interested in lifestyle. But Dr. Breslow had this theory. He thought if he just studied how people lived, he could predict how long they would live. And so Dr. Breslow was at this conference, and he was one of the high-profile speakers, and I was just off in one of the breakout sessions. But we got to meet and talk together, and I heard his presentation. And so he shared in both those contexts, personally with me and to the group that was gathered there for that conference, some background about what's now very famous in public health circles called the Alameda County Health Study. And Dr. Breslow explained back in those days, there wasn't a lot of concern about conflict of interest. So you'd have these researchers come from the National Institutes of Health when you had a proposal, and they'd, you know, eat with you, and, you know, you'd socialize together. I mean, that doesn't happen today. You know, they just look at the research proposal. It's all very professional and, you know, arm's length. So no one thinks, well, they were your friends, and that's why you gave them grant money. So Dr. Breslow hosted these experts from the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., Rockville, Maryland, actually. He hosted them for several days, telling them about this great idea he had. He was going to recruit several thousand people in the Bay Area. He was going to study them for a number of years. And then he was going to show that their lifestyle habits actually had a bearing on how long they lived. At the end of those 3 days, they said, Breslow, you're a nice guy and all, but this is the craziest idea we've ever had. We're not going to give you any money. And that's why that study almost never happened. But a few years later, researchers at the National Cancer Institute remembered Dr. Lester Breslow, and they gave him a call. And they said, you know what, we remember that idea you had. We'd like to fund your study. And so the Alameda County Health Study was born back in the early 60s. They recruited some 7,000 individuals, and they studied them initially for about 9 years. And they found with these very simple health practices, they could predict how long someone would live. I mean, really simple things like exercising and not smoking and not carrying too much weight. I mean, all these things that right now I mention them to you and you say, well, everybody knows that. Well, back then they didn't. They hadn't put it all together. And so in 1970, when this research came out in the journal Preventive Medicine, it was an amazing study. Because the difference in longevity was remarkable for people following simple health habits. They had like half or a quarter the risk of dying over the course of 9 or 10 years. They say, wait a minute, Dr. DeRose. You started by telling us that there was somehow not this dichotomy, this divorcing, if you will, between health and happiness. But now you're just telling us the same kind of things we've always heard. You're telling us that if I do these things that are unenjoyable, like exercising and stopping smoking and losing weight, I'm going to live longer. That's the same message we've heard all along. That's why we don't like all that stuff that they put in the newspapers. Just wait a minute. I told you that researchers were getting very interested in quality of life. And so that's exactly what happened with these Alameda County researchers. They started to look as they continued to follow this group over the years. And as far as I know, the study is still ongoing. When I met Dr. Breslow some years ago, it was probably 5 or 10 years ago now, the study was still ongoing of the original 7,000 people back in the 60s. I think there were less than 1,000 still alive. But they were still following this population. And some years after they published that first research, they started looking at some other things besides longevity. They started looking at, guess what? Quality of life. Quality of life. And you know what they found? They found that when you looked at quality of life, and when you looked at things like disability and things that rob us of quality of life, they found the very same health habits that help people live a long time actually increased their quality of life. I mean, this is not a unique study. Because study after study shows that actually the same practices that prevent heart disease and cancer and high blood pressure and diabetes are the habits that increase quality of life. You say, well, I don't know. I mean, so you've got some letters after your name, you're an MD, you've got a master's in public health, and you've run all over the country, and you've done some things on television. I'm not sure about all this. I mean, who cares, after all, who you are? Because I've tried it in my own life, it doesn't work. A lot of people feel that way. They say, when the doctor tells me to do something, it just makes me miserable. You know? They're always telling me to do something. And so finally, actually, this is true. A lot of doctors, you know, they go to medical school and they hear about how powerful lifestyle choices are. But many of them, after a while, they just stop telling anything to their patients. I actually got quite upset one time because a doctor came to lecture to a number of us physicians. He was one of these, you know, high-powered endocrinologists. He was a diabetologist, actually, especially his diabetes. And he came and he started giving us this wonderful presentation, telling us how good exercise was for people with diabetes. And then he started telling us, after about 2 minutes, how good diet was. For maybe a minute or two. And then he said this. He said, but don't waste your time. Just put your patients on insulin. I got pretty upset. And so when he spent the whole rest of the time talking about insulin. When we know how powerful these lifestyle things are. And when he asked for questions at the end, I asked him, well, you said don't tell your patients about lifestyle. I said, how much time do you spend tell your patients about lifestyle? Now, granted, there are many people that have gotten discouraged in the path of better health. But I want to tell you something tonight. That I learned something that addressed this issue in my own life that was extremely powerful. And it was this. I learned that we have the ability to choose what we will enjoy. We actually have the capacity to choose our pleasures. Are you aware of that? If you are, you're far ahead of where I was at one point in my life. I didn't realize this. I didn't realize that the way the human organism works, and I would say designed. I can't explain it any other way. That we're somehow designed with this capacity to choose what we want to enjoy. When this sunk into my mind, when it sunk into me personally, I said, wait a minute. If I can really choose whatever lifestyle I want to follow, why don't I just choose the best one? Now, some of you might be a little bit skeptical, but let me make it very practical. Now, I don't know this area very well. This is my first time, this beautiful part of California. I actually trained in Southern California, but had never been up around Mount Shasta. So I want to thank all of you for not only inviting me to be here, but, not having California Highway Patrol out, stopping me on the way up here, telling me that, spreading some rumors that I was up to no good. So I'm glad to be here. First time here, though. So I don't know much about the lay of the land here. So I got to ask you a question. Do you have any kind of a restaurant here that has like a buffet where you can choose certain items? Do you have anything like that in Mount Shasta? Okay, I see some heads saying no, others nodding their head yes. Well, those of you that are nodding your head yes, tell us the secret. Where can you get a buffet meal here? What is it called? Lai Lai? Oh, you can see I don't speak Chinese. Okay, Lai Lai's. Okay, so we go over to Lai Lai's. And you go to the buffet, and you're choosing foods. And you pick this and that. And as you've got your tray here, you're walking away from the buffet service. And there's a very distinguished gentleman there. He's got a goatee beard, graying, and very nicely dressed. And he says, he introduces himself. He says, hello, I'm a research professor at Stanford, and I'm wondering if I can just ask you a few questions. What would you do in this situation? I mean, it's highly unusual. But you look, you look like you're a very nice group. A number of you I see, you look like you're pretty open to such a request. So you say, sure, go ahead. What do you want to know? And he asks you, he says, why did you choose those particular foods that are on your tray? And you say, I chose these foods because I like them. Wrong. I mean, what the nerve of that guy. You kind of look like, here I'm doing you a favor. And you tell me I'm wrong? I just told you why I chose these foods. You might not say that. And he says, let me explain. You didn't choose those foods because you like them. You like those foods because you've been choosing them. Now, I have to tell you, whether that makes sense to you or not, that's what all the research tells us. That we actually develop an enjoyment for the things that we habitually choose. Think about it for a minute. I don't care how you want to illustrate it, whether you want to think on your own childhood experiences, or maybe you want to think of some cross-cultural experience you once had. Have any of you ever eaten at the table of someone from a totally different culture? Any of you relate to this? Okay, I see some nods and some hands raising. Now, a lot of times when we have more of a discussion class, I sometimes do things on lifestyle change with smaller groups. We'll actually have people tell their stories. And I've heard some amazing stories. And what's so amazing to me is when you're being hosted by someone from another culture, they'll often want to please you. That's typically the way it is, isn't it? And so they'll give you some of their finest foods. One woman told me, she was looking at that delicious soup she was served. She was given the soup of honor. She was the guest. And as she looked at it, it did not look all that palatable. For she could see eyeballs floating in the soup. Oh, really? Many stories like this. And others that may not have looked disgusting. But once the person took a bite of the food, it was all they could do not to spit it out. Can any of you relate to this at all? Well, what's going on here? How can someone serve you their finest meal that they think is delicious, wonderful, and you don't like it? How could that be? It's because you've not been habitually choosing that kind of food, you see? And it works both ways. You could tell me maybe about some foods that you never liked, but you started eating it and things changed. You know, I mentioned earlier on in the Alameda County Health Study that one of the behaviors that shortened lifespan was cigarette smoking. Now, you know, today, everybody knows that. But many of you likely have been smokers at one time. What do you think it is? I've done a lot of work with people who are dealing with nicotine addiction. What do you think people tell me about their first experience with cigarettes if they're a current smoker? What do you think they tell me? You think they tell me, well, you know, the first time I took a puff on a cigarette, I felt like, you know, this is what life was all about. I was transported to a higher state of existence. Is that what they say? No, this is not typical. What they usually say is they started coughing, or they got sick to their stomach, or they vomited, or they got dizzy. Very unpleasurable experiences. But what happens? How did they ever become a chain smoker or a pack per day smoker or whatever they were doing? What changed? They stuck with it. And they developed an enjoyment for it. They say, well, Dr. DeRose, there's nicotine. There's nicotine in that tobacco, and they got addicted. But it's more than just having nicotine there, you see? We tend to develop, and sure, the nicotine helped. Don't misunderstand me. But we develop enjoyments for the things we habitually do. Now, how many of you would like to help me tonight and tell me an example, very briefly, of a good lifestyle change you made that at first was distasteful, but you stuck with it, and now you actually enjoy it? Can any of you have an example like that? I see someone pointing to someone. Who are you pointing to? Oh, we got a mic. Oh, this is incredible. If I knew that, I would have had the mic passing around long before this. Tell us.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I've known for years and years and years how healthy kale is, that leafy green vegetable. But I seldom bought it and ate it because I didn't like it. But not so very long ago, I bought some. And on the way home, or when I got home, I took a piece and I ate it raw. And I went, ugh. Now I eat raw kale every single day because I persevered with it.
So you're just punishing yourself? Is that it? It still tastes bad? No, help us. Here, don't give the mic away. So is it still as bad as it was the first time?
I love it. It's addictive.
Wow.
Almost to me.
Isn't that amazing? This is not a unique story. Anyone else with a similar experience? Okay, another one right here.
When I don't jog a lot now, but I do hike and I'm very athletic. But when I first started jogging, it was so hard just to get the little ways down. I was athletic, but it was hard. And the more I did it, I just loved it more and more. And I would dream of leaping and, you know, it just entered my whole being once I got used to the jogging and I could do a little more and a little more. So the more I did it, the more I loved it.
Wonderful, wonderful. Anyone else? These were two excellent examples. We don't need any more, but we've got Dr. Guthrie here. We've got to hear Dr. Guthrie's story.
I don't know about you, but a lot of us grew up on milk, and with some of the research and the different information that came in, we decided to go away from milk and dairy. And I thought, well, how could I ever enjoy this other stuff on my cereal? It just doesn't taste the same, you know. And I noticed a funny thing after a period of time of choosing the soy milk or whatever, rice milk, whatever, that I grew to enjoy that taste. And then I had the opportunity, or maybe it was the, you know, that wasn't available, so there was some milk, and I was like, well, I'll just try this. And it tasted kind of bitter and just didn't taste the same anymore.
Isn't that amazing? Many of us could tell stories like this, but it's not just stories. This is medical research. There have been many studies that have shown this very same thing in a very standardized scientific way. They've shown it with salt. That's one of the classic things. Some of you may have seen your doctor, and the doctor said, you know, you got high blood pressure. Some people, if they lower their salt intake, their blood pressure will really come under better control. And so you dramatically decrease the salt in your diet. And when you ate that food with the low salt in it, it just tasted terrible. Terrible! And you said, I mean, I used to like to eat. I mean, so who cares if I have high blood pressure? I mean, think about it. I mean, so what if I die when I'm 75? You know, that's what people say in their 40s. But believe me, once you get to be 74, most people don't say that. But so you say, okay, so who cares? If I die when I'm 75, at least I'll have been happy all those years. Who wants to live to be 85 and be miserable the whole time? But if you stick with that low-sodium diet, what happens after a while? You develop an enjoyment for low-sodium foods. And if you saved a treat for your birthday, that high-sodium casserole or whatever you really enjoyed, you put it in the freezer. And after a year, you say, I'm going to celebrate. I've been denying myself for so long. I'm going to have this high-sodium food. I've been just waiting, salivating for a whole year, thinking about it. And you warm it up. And how does that first bite taste? Terrible, right? Because your tastes have changed. Now, Dr. Guthrie raised a question about my background. Did you catch that in it? He said, I don't know how it was with you. Did you hear him say that? So I'll tell you about my background. I'll be honest with you. I grew up with some good health habits. You know, one of those factors that I didn't mention to you in the Alameda County Health Study that was associated with longevity and quality of life was eating breakfast. I was a regular breakfast eater even as a teenager. I mean, I have vivid memories of taking the bus to high school and getting off the school bus and going right to those vending machines and picking up a candy bar and Coke. Really? Every morning? It's true. And some of you, actually, you hadn't met me until tonight, but you knew about my reputation. I grew up in the Chicago area, and we had these restaurants there. They had these, like, gold bars. They're kind of like a... Yeah, an arch. Yeah, exactly. Do you have any...
McDonald's,
exactly. And I noticed something. The more I went there, they started changing the sign. You know, I think it was first 1,000 served and then millions. And yeah, so some of you knew about my dietary habits even though you hadn't met me. Because they changed those signs out here too, probably. Yeah. So I was frequenting the fast food restaurants. I was not on a healthy lifestyle. Even though my parents tried to do their best, you know, I was a teenager and then a young adult, didn't really know much about health. So when I talk to people about healthy lifestyle choices, believe me, I've made lots of changes. I actually don't go to McDonald's anymore. I do eat breakfast still, but no more candy bars and Cokes. And you know what? Even though in my own life some of those changes were difficult, just like you've been sharing, just like the medical research said, I developed new enjoyments. And so here's the great thing about making this connection. You see, because when I made this connection, like I told you already, when I made this connection, I said, look it, if I can develop an enjoyment for any lifestyle, why don't I pick what? The very best one. Right? If I can enjoy anything. And so that's what I did. I started to change my lifestyle. And even though we usually think of habits and changing habits as being difficult, is that true? It is true. I know. I mean, I've changed many habits. It's not easy. But after you change the habit and you stick with the kale or the exercise or the soy milk or whatever it is, you start to enjoy it. Plus, you get the benefits of a healthier lifestyle. So when I talk to people about health, it's not talking about something that takes quality out of your life. It's an exciting message that gives you all kinds of benefits and actually adds to the quality of your life. So when the Guthries talked with me about coming here and giving some health presentations, I said my favorite health presentation to give first is on this subject of changing bad habits for good. Because I find that all over the world, and I've lectured all over the world, that people have this concept in their minds that they're all kind of, a bit wary about changing too much. Because after all, you'll make your life miserable. You'll be dull and boring. It's just the opposite. Now, I have to tell you, though, because many of you have tried to change your lifestyle and have not succeeded, I have to tell you, in my experience from having worked with thousands of people, that there is one thing more than anything else that will undermine this wonderful ability that you have to develop new enjoyments. You like to know what that one thing is? One word. Rewards. Rewards. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's nothing wrong with rewards. But it's just the rewards that we typically choose to give ourselves. Let me just give you a scenario. Let's say one of you in this room tonight weighs 700 pounds. Now, I might impress you with my clinical abilities tonight as both a board-certified internal medicine specialist and preventive medicine specialist and tell you, even though I've never seen the scale for any of you, I don't think there's any one of you here tonight that's even close to 700 pounds. You impressed with my finely honed diagnostic skills? Okay, some of you are. So hypothetical situation is what we're talking about here. 700-pounder here in the church came here, why? Because they have diabetes and heart disease and weight problems, and they want help. And so they stay after, and they tell me their story. And I take a little dietary history, and it turns out that this individual is eating 4 pounds. Did you hear the amount? 4 pounds of chocolate a day. Did you catch that? 4 pounds of chocolate a day. And so I say, 4 pounds of chocolate a day? No wonder you have a weight problem and diabetes and heart disease. I mean, this is not helping you. You need to stop eating the chocolate. Now, I wouldn't be that directive here, because I don't actually treat people just when I come to a lecture. I usually just give them, educational material. But if they were in my office, I might say something like that. And some of you are hearing this, you say, wait a minute. What did you say? I said, I would tell them to stop eating chocolate. You say, stop. Did you realize what the person just said? 4 pounds of chocolate a day. Now, let me ask you a question. How about if they just cut back to 1 Snickers bar a day? Wouldn't that be a tremendous amount of progress? And so they say that. They still make Snickers bars? Okay. So, person says that to me. They say, Dr. DeRose, they're in my office now. We've changed the hypothetical situation. Dr. DeRose, but how about if I can just have 1 Snickers bar a day? And I said, no, 0. I said, no chocolate. Now, I usually don't talk to patients that way, but it's a hypothetical situation, so we can do whatever we want, right? None. The person says, but Dr. DeRose, I don't think you understand. I was raised during the Depression. The only job that my mother could get was cleaning the floor of the M&M Mars candy factory. This is what gave us life. She could keep the candy that was on the floor. Dr. DeRose, Snickers bars are life to me. What should I say then? Well, I tell you that story because what happens for many of us is we have some reason that we have to hold on just a little bit to our bad habits. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm not telling you that you can never eat chocolate again. But if you're 700 pounds and have diabetes, heart disease, and a weight problem, and you're eating 4 pounds of chocolate a day, you probably do need to give up chocolate completely. And here's why. I want to ask you a question. Now, I hardly know most of you in this room. So this is a very dangerous request to make, but I am going to request that you answer me honestly, okay? Now, you realize I've never been to Mount Shasta area before. And some of you are thinking, well, if we answer honestly, Dr. DeRose will have this opinion about folks who live in this area. Just forget about all that, okay? I just want you to answer me honestly. Is that an easy enough request to make? Here's the question. What sounds more pleasing to you? To give up something for a little while? Now, let me ask it this way. What sounds better? To deny yourself for a little while, or to deny yourself for the rest of your life? What sounds better? Just tell me honestly. Just go ahead and speak up. Little while. Great. Thanks for being honest. Because that's what everyone tells me when they're honest. Do you realize what you just said? You just made a powerful argument for making clean breaks with your bad habits. Let me explain. You see, if that 700-pound patient said, I'm just going to eat one Hershey's Kiss a week, what would happen to them on a psychological and emotional level? Would they be telling themselves that chocolate was bad? No, they'd be telling themselves that chocolate was delicious, good. It's something that I have to reward myself with once a week. I have a chocolate over here. And if I stay away from it all week long, I can just enjoy that one chocolate kiss. But what happens? That's right. They start looking at their watch. 6 days, 23 hours, and 12 minutes, and I can eat chocolate again. Do you see? We think we're doing ourselves a favor when we cut back on the things that may be undermining our health, when the real power is in changing lifestyle, you see? It's not holding on to the cow's milk if there's a reason to stop it in your case. Do you see? It's making a clean break with it. It's having the kale every day, having it frequently, changing your lifestyle. It's going out and exercising, even though you don't like it. But we say, you know what? I'll wait for the weather. I'm going to start an exercise program, but I'm going to exercise when the weather is good. Every day, when it's nice out, I'm going to exercise. Do you know what I learned many years ago? I learned that no matter where you live, there's always a number of days of the year that's perfect exercise weather. Really. And it usually comes down to somewhere around 2 or 3. I'm exaggerating a bit. But really, this is what I hear from people all the time. This is why I started an exercise program, you know, but the second week of my exercise program, it started raining. You know, it rained for several weeks and I got off my program. Years ago, I learned something very interesting about exercise. Someone told me this piece of age-old wisdom, because I was not a regular exerciser, mind you. They told me this piece of age-old wisdom, and it went like this. When it comes to exercise, there's no such thing as bad weather. Only bad clothing. Now, granted, that's a bit of a hyperbole. We wouldn't recommend you going out in the middle of a thunder and lightning storm or going out running in the woods when you had those trees falling down all around you not too many days ago. But if I caught that concept, and you know, when it rained out, I just put my rain gear on. I can't tell you it was real fun when I was first developing an exercise program. I actually got on a regular exercise program. Just you might be curious to know this. When I was living in the coldest place I've ever lived. It wasn't Chicago. It was much colder than Chicago, actually. I was living in Minnesota. And in those northern plains, I mean, get to 40 or 50 below. That's without the wind chill. I remember once with the wind chill, it was like 100 below. That's where I got on a regular exercise program. And it was like you. It wasn't fun at first. It took me a number of years before something finally dawned on me. You see, I used to stop exercising when I got busy. You know, I got really busy, I'd stop exercising. It finally dawned on me that the time I most needed to exercise was when I felt I was the busiest. And then I continued an exercise program because it made me feel better. I performed better. I required less sleep. I had more energy. I got sick less. Yes, even going out in the winter and exercising, I was healthier. So I tell you all these things tonight because tomorrow I'm going to be making a couple of presentations. And some of you may have looked at these. You may say, ancient secrets, modern health. I mean, this guy's going to tell us about, you know, lifestyle practices and things that ancient cultures were doing. Well, that sounds kind of interesting, but, you know, he might tell me something that would make me change my lifestyle. I mean, I don't know that I really want to. I have a hard enough life already. Why would I want to change anything else? How many of you have heard something tonight that would make you more open to learning about healthier lifestyle practices? Have any of you heard anything? We've got a mic. I want to just hear what's going on in your own minds. Because, you know, sometimes I speak with patients or give a lecture, and someone comes up afterwards, they say, Dr. DeRose, that was the most marvelous thing I've ever heard. And they proceed to tell me what they learned, and it was nothing I said that evening at all. You know, I was thankful they were inspired, but I don't know what they were talking about. So I'd like to hear from you. So we've got a mic. We've got someone who's raising their hand. Is some of you willing to tell us what's happened, what's changed in your thinking? I saw hands go up. Okay, there's a young lady there in the green and blue.
Well, I was especially impressed by your concept of rewarding ourselves with the thing that we're attempting to get rid of. And one of the lifestyle changes that I'm in process of is releasing white sugar and foods of that sort. Mm-hmm. But a downfall that's come up for me is I'll go along a certain while adapting to what seems to be a blander diet and becoming more acquainted with enjoying fresh, delicious fruits.
Wonderful.
And actually, some vegetables taste sweet and delicious to me, leafy greens. And I'll go along for a while, and then when I'm with friends out eating and there's a delicious chocolate cake or some sumptuous dessert, I find myself having this thought, oh, I'll splurge, I'll indulge, I'll give myself this extra pleasure. And the truth is, it is sinfully delicious at the time. It's very pleasurable. And then I find myself backsliding. And the concept that you brought up was something that has come up in my past, But it was really came home to me just now, is that if I continue to go back to it, then I will not adapt fully to a complete lifestyle change. So that's what I've heard just now, that if I only heard that one thing, I can't come tomorrow morning, but if I only heard that one thing, it's made a big difference for me. And thank
wonderful,
you.
Wonderful, wonderful. In addition to tomorrow morning's program, tomorrow night, in addition to the program, we'll have some resources here that will be available for sale that can help you with lifestyle changes and other issues. So some of you, if you're not able to be here, you might meet someone here, a friend, and tell them to look out for you. But I want to just share something with you, because you're exactly right, and I think that point came through very clearly. I appreciate you sharing your experience. And your name is?
Lisa.
Lisa. Thank you, Lisa. Let me tell you something that happened in my own life, because I struggled with this very same thing. I came to a point where I had said, I've got to leave out everything with these added sugars in them. Because just to let you know about my, I didn't tell you all about my background, but I could not go to sleep at night unless I had a sweet snack. So cake or ice cream, or so, that was the routine I was on as a young adult. And one of my favorite snacks was ice cream. But I actually made a clean break with all these things. And a number of years later, did you hear what I said? It wasn't weeks or months, this was years later. After I developed, my taste had changed. I was a member of a small, informal singing group. Now, I'm really not a very good singer, and you might appreciate it this more when I tell you where we used to sing. We used to sing for shut-ins. So even if they didn't like the music, they couldn't leave. Yeah. So that was my main role in a singing group. And we were singing for this home of people who, they were housebound. And we didn't realize what was going on as we were singing there. But the people who were caring for these elderly individuals were very touched by our singing. And so they slipped into the kitchen. And they came out after a while with a large tray with festive party plates. And on each of those plates was a scoop of ice cream and some cookies. Now, Lisa, if I was at the point in the lifestyle change where you've been, I might have said, well, I'll just splurge and eat these, and it would have put me back to square one. But this was I had made this lifestyle change a long time ago, and in fact, when I looked at the ice cream and cookies, they didn't even look good. But, you know, we just met these people. I mean, they were touched, they were being kind to us, and I felt, well, I just felt I should not just stand up and say, you know, I'm on a healthy lifestyle now. I can't eat any of this. Why didn't you ask me first? No, I figured I couldn't do that. It wasn't eyeball soup either. That's right. And I noticed something. I have to tell you what I noticed. You know, sometimes your senses become hyper acute in a time of stress. I noticed the fellow next to me, he did something with the cookies. He slipped them into his pocket when no one was looking. Great idea. I just followed suit. Put those cookies in the pocket. How many of you ever tried slipping a scoop of ice cream in your pocket? Yeah, that wasn't going to work. So what I did is I started slowly eating that ice cream. I figured if I ate it slowly, you know, it would kind of melt, the cookies would be gone, it would look like I ate most of it. And so I'm eating this ice cream. Now remember, this used to be one of my favorite foods. And as I'm eating it, I kid you not, I started to get nauseated. Really? And I'm eating and it tastes so sweet and so rich. And I just ate a little of it. And when I got out of that house, I said to myself, how did I used to eat this all the time? You see, my taste had changed. And instead of it now becoming some great act of willpower to follow a lifestyle, it's no willpower at all. You see? Because I stopped rewarding myself. And in that unusual situation, it's only happened once. I actually felt in that context that you got to be careful. You got to make sure you're really supposed to do it in that context. But it was just a very illuminating experience because I saw again this power of how we can develop new enjoyments. Now, I have to tell you something. I give this presentation or presentations like this to many audiences. Sometimes it's to audiences that want nothing to do with religion. Here we're in a church. And it's interesting to be in a Christian church and talk about this subject. Because most Christians, even if they haven't gone to church in many years, most people from a Jewish background, even if they haven't been to synagogue for years, this Judeo-Christian tradition that kind of, you know, many of us have in our background, most people have heard a story that comes from the Hebrew scriptures. And it's a story about God speaking from a mountain. He gives these ten Mount Mountain, you remember this, right? Ten commandments? Is that what he gave? Commandments? Are you sure? I mean, as a physician, I'm going to be honest with you. I've noticed that people don't like commandments. They like suggestions. You see? They're much happier with the doctor who suggests something. Or if their neighbor suggests. How many of you like people to command you? No. But you're right. God on that mountain gave 10 what? Commandments. Now, have you ever thought about it? Why did he give 10 commandments and not 10 suggestions? I mean, you know what these commandments are about, don't you? I mean, there's one about not stealing, isn't there? So think about it. Let's say someone is a thief. They're stealing every day. I mean, is this good for themselves and for society? Is that good? No. So wouldn't it have been good if God just suggested that if you're prone to stealing, just steal less? That wouldn't have helped. Well, how about this? There's something in those Ten Commandments about, it has to do with relationships. You know, I think it says something pretty strong, like, don't commit adultery. Am I remembering it right? Do you know, we know as physicians today that sexual promiscuity is at the root of many, many health problems. So let's say someone's with a different partner every night. I mean, this is very risky business health-wise. So wouldn't it have been good for God just to suggest that you have fewer partners? Really? Well, wouldn't that help decrease health risk? Wouldn't it? I mean, I'd like to suggest to you it would. Why did God give commandments, though? Have you ever thought about it? Now, I think we could talk about a number of reasons tonight. But I'd like to suggest to you one in the context of what we've been speaking about. And it's simply this. There's no power in suggestions. But there's actually power in commandments. There's power in making clean breaks, in leaving something behind. And the amazing thing about the God of the Bible, and I'm telling you this as someone who once was an agnostic, but I've come to see that there really is a God. And if that God speaks to your heart or speaks to you through the Bible or through nature, whatever way he communicates to you, that if he's asking you to make a change in your lifestyle, he's fully committed to help you be successful. You see? So we don't have to worry about what God may be leading us to do. Because whatever God asks, he gives us the power to change. Now, with Dr. DeRose, I mean, I might ask you to do something or suggest something that doesn't sound like that good an idea. You don't have to do it. But if you ever, on a spiritual level, have a conviction about change, that's powerful. You know why I tell you this, especially tonight? Because if we gave you time for questions and answers tonight, and I don't know if we're going to do that. We need to wind up here shortly. If we have time for questions and answers, one of the questions you might ask would go like this. Dr. DeRose, you told us we could develop new enjoyments. How long does that take? How long does it take? You said, just stick with it. How long do I have to stick with it? And the answer I would give you is this. It depends. That's right. It depends. You know, one of the things it depends on is why you're changing. I've noticed over the years that people that have a spiritual conviction that they need to change typically can make lifestyle changes much quicker. I've seen people in a day or two. Their desires have changed. It's like miraculous. Some people say, well, that's why. You know, it is miraculous. And I've seen other people, years after the change, are still having trouble. Now, you say it's very discouraging. But let me tell you. Here's the story. I want to give you a true story. I told you some years ago, I did a lot of work with nicotine addiction. I was living in the New York City area at the time, and we ran a clinic there. A lot of people would come to our clinic to stop smoking. We had a one-week residential stop smoking program. They'd come, we'd help them get over their nicotine addiction and be smoke-free. And so people were starting to know about me in the New York City area. And I got an email. And I got an email from this woman I'd never met. I don't know where she learned about what I was doing. And she said, Dr. DeRose, I have a terrible problem. And she went on to describe this terrible story. Now, it sounded wonderful at first, because it went like this. She had a boyfriend who cared very much about her, and she was a smoker. Her boyfriend wanted to help her stop smoking. Well, she also had another need. She needed a car, but she had no money. And so her boyfriend said, if you stop smoking, I will buy you a new car. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And so she said, it's a deal. And so she stopped smoking, and he bought her a new car. He said, though the only catch is, before he bought the car, he said, if you go back to smoking, you have to pay me for the car. She wrote me 2 years later. She said, I've been wanting a cigarette every day since I stopped. My life is miserable, but I don't have money to pay for the car. And I've got this car. I would like to suggest to you that although she made a clean break with the habit behaviorally, she never made a clean break with it mentally. You see? So if you're going to make a change and you realize this change is going to benefit you, just make the change. Say, I'm going to start walking down a new path. And tomorrow morning, we're going to look from a very fascinating perspective at ancient cultures. It's a fascinating, one of my favorite subjects. We're going to look at different ancient cultures and the cultural wisdom they had that's now being validated by modern science. We're going to also find something that's fascinating to me from my background as an agnostic. It's actually supported in the scriptures. Very interesting. And then tomorrow night, we'll be speaking about the Methuselah factor. How many of you ever heard the name of Methuselah? Yeah. Even people who haven't read the Bible, they've heard that expression, as old as Methuselah. Methuselah was the one who was reputed to have lived the longest on this planet. And so we're going to talk about hemoreology. How many of you know everything you ever wanted to know about hemoreology? Okay. It's fascinating. This is about optimal circulation, how you can improve your circulation. We'll see how this can help you prevent cancer and heart disease and stroke and even help you lose weight if you need to lose weight. And if you don't, it won't cause you to waste away to nothing. By the way, if any of you are wondering, thinking I'm too thin, my weight is very stable, okay? So you don't have to worry about me. I'm not actually wasting away. Okay? I don't know. Is this time to close or do we have some time for questions and answers? Okay, so you're all formally dismissed? Okay, if some of you have some questions, then we've got a mic in back, and we'll do this. Tomorrow I'll have some time if you need to talk with me individually after the morning program or after the evening program. Even tonight I'll linger around for a bit. Do any of you have a question you think might be of general interest? Okay, we have a comment up here. Do you want to bring the mic up to this lady here in the purple? Kathleen? No. Kim. Kimberly.
Hi. This is a blessing to have you here. It really is.
Good to be here.
I have a friend named Scott who told me years ago, he grew up in Chicago, of all places, and he was wanting to quit smoking cigarettes, but he allowed himself one cigarette a day. And he did that for like 4 or 5 years. He had his one cigarette a day that he would allow himself to have at night. And sometimes he'd smoke a little bit and put it out and then take a little more and put it out. But he kept on that for one day. And he said for a long time he thought he was really being tough, that he'd gotten it down to that one cigarette. But then after a while he realized that he was really wrestling with just this one cigarette, that he didn't have the power over it. It had the power over him because mm-hmm. he was still stuck on just that one a day mm-hmm. thing. And so finally when he quit because it was like, you know, I'm going to beat you and you're not going to beat me. And he finally quit. But he thought for a long time in his mind that he had control over it when it still had control over him.
Yeah, it's a good point. You see, for 5 years, he was living a life of continual denial. All day long, he was denying himself something that he was saying was good. And he only became free, he only stopped living a life of denial when he made the clean break. It's a remarkable story, because most people who try things like that, they end up back in the throes of the old habit as fully as it was before. I know of many people who did things like that for weeks or months and then went right back to their old former usage as well.
Well, see, that's where he thought he was bad because he kept it at one cigarette all that time and he did not go back into a pack a day or whatever it was.
But very good illustration. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments? The only way you know for sure that I'll answer your question is if you ask it now. You know, if there's a big line afterwards sometimes, you don't know. And then everyone else benefits from it. And if it's something very personal, you can just say, I know this person, you know, and...
I'll say I think the clean break is a lot better than trying to rationalize and... You know, when I don't do caffeine at all, I am so much better off. But then when I feel stressed and pressured and I go, oh, I'll just have a cup of coffee and it starts up again.
That's right.
My body just reacts and says, stop, stop, stop. And you can't, I think the clean break is a whole lot better.
Yeah, let me just tell you something about this because right now I work at Weimar Center of Health and Education. How many of you have heard of Weimar? Weimar, we run residential lifestyle change programs. People come to us from all over the world. It's about, how long did it take us to get here? 5 hours or something away outside of Auburn, California, off of I-80 there. And people come to change their lifestyles. They come with diabetes and heart disease and weight problems. And it's very interesting in these lifestyle programs. I've worked in a number of centers like this over the years. But often I'll tell in the lecture, because right now at Weimar, we've got three doctors there, three physicians. So if you were to come to a program, you may have me for a doctor. You may have someone else. You know, after you meet me here, you say, you know, I want one of the other doctors beside Dr. DeRose. And that's fine. You can request that. So what I would do in the lectures I'd give sometimes is I would say something like, if you're my patient and you hear that I put one of my patients on a fast for several days, don't say, whoa, I'm glad Dr. DeRose didn't do that to me. You should instead say, what? How come they got to go on a fast and not me? And the point I'm trying to make is, you see, most of us look for the easiest path. But sometimes what we really need is something that sounds hard, but it's really the path to freedom. You see? It's a path to freedom. And so from that spiritual perspective, again, when God speaks to you about lifestyle change, He has the power to help you be successful. Okay? Other questions or comments tonight? Is there a question up here in front? Okay. I see some young folks here. Now, these happen to be my sons and my daughter. And that other one's not my other daughter, it's my wife. But you kids, you've heard this lecture before. You don't have any questions? Just because you can ask me at the breakfast table? Okay, we've got one back here. Wait for the mic.
Well, now that I've got the mic, I'll confess that I've cut down on a lot of sugar. I've avoided high fructose corn syrup for more than a few years. And recently I discovered that Burger King was serving a veggie burger. And when I bit into it, it was like a sugar burger. It was just all high fructose corn syrup and the bread and the ketchup and the whole thing. And my mouth waters at the thought, but I've put that behind me. Huh. But I was going to ask you about xylitol.
Okay.
A sweetener made from birch bark.
Mm-hmm.
And your opinion on using that as a substitute sweetener.
Okay. There's a number of sweet compounds that are in the alcohol family. It doesn't mean they're addictive like ethanol, which is beverage alcohol. So anything that ends in O-L is actually an alcohol. So xylitol is chemically an alcohol, has a sweet flavor to it. Sorbitol is another one of these sweet alcohols. What? Mannitol. Yeah. So there's a number of these sweet alcohols. The main problem with them is they can cause digestive upset in some people and diarrhea. So some people have problems in that way. When it comes to any artificial sweeteners, what I usually encourage people with from the standpoint of health behavior change is try to do away with all of the artificial sweeteners, because otherwise you never re-educate your tastes to enjoy those simple things like Lisa was talking about, the fruits and the sweet veg. You know, substitute those. It's much more powerful as far as long-term success. So I'm not, don't have something particularly against it if you tolerate it. But again, if you're eating things that are sweeter than they come in their natural state, then that's just cultivating that sweet tooth and that sweet desire. Okay? Lisa?
A lot of people might relate to, and that is you can be on a what you consider to be a very healthy sugar-free diet for a long time or for a period of time, and then stress alone will cause the adrenals to go hyper, mm-hmm. and the blood sugar goes so low, and that's the time when, even if you've been developing a new lifestyle, it seems very difficult to get through the day, like a long 10-hour day or something. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, where stress alone, it will give you the same physiological effect as if you had eaten a big piece of dessert.
Yeah, what stress does, it's true. Stress hormones raise blood sugar. And the interesting thing, there's something else that happens with stress, is many of us try to go to something that we've connected with relaxation. Herbert Benson at Harvard coined a phrase, the relaxation response. And you can actually develop a relaxation response to even something that raises stress hormones in your body. It's the amazing thing. Cigarette smoking is a classic one. So cigarette smoking on a chemical level actually raises stress hormone levels. That's what nicotine does. But most smokers have developed a relaxation response. When they take the cigarette, they say, this is my cue, now I can relax. I just finished my job, or I just finished eating, and I can relax now. So when we're under stress, there's two dangers. One is, yes, it does boost up our blood sugar a bit. But the other thing is, we can feel a need to go to something that we associate with relaxation, even if it's not intrinsically relaxing. So this is why I encourage people to develop new enjoyments. What do you do when you're under stress? Sometimes I do a series of classes on this subject that I'm talking with you about tonight in just 1 hour. But we'll tell people to write down the high-risk situations in which they engaged in that old habit that they're trying to break with. And why we do that is, let's say it's stress is one of those. So we'll say, look it, Victor, if under stress, you would eat candy bars. Is that one of your bad habits?
Not exactly.
No, he says not exactly. I don't know. Have you ever eaten a candy bar? He's not sure?
He's not going to tell.
He's not going to tell in public. I know his parents have never given him one. So thank you for being honest, Victor, and saying you don't remember or acting like you didn't. Anyway, so Victor, let's say, we know this is hypothetical, he already said this is not his tendency, but let's say he eats a candy bar whenever he's under stress, and now he wants to make a clean break with that. Don't make the mistake of only saying what you're not going to do. Don't say, one thing I know, when I get under stress, I'm not going to eat a candy bar. I'm not going to smoke. Say what you are going to do. I'm going to take a walk. I'm going to I'm going to call Aunt Harriet. I'm going to go in the washroom and take a shower. By the way, that's a very good place to go when you're under temptation. I have noticed that most people, no matter what their bad habit is, they usually do not do it in the shower. Now, there may be a few that people do, but that's usually a safe haven for most bad habits. Not too many people smoke in the shower, eat in the shower. You know, you get the picture. So your water bill goes up for a while, you'll understand. But you develop a new approach. You know what? It's not going to be the same as the candy bar or the cigarette. But after a while, if it's something that gives you benefit, like exercise, or maybe taking up a musical instrument, or doing something else that you develop a new relaxation response for, then it won't be like, well, what am I going to do now? You'll have developed something else that can help you unwind even in the face of stress. Okay? So thank you for that. Well, we do need to wind up. You promised 15 minutes for questions and answers, and according to my watch, it's probably at least that. So are there any final remarks before we say goodnight? Okay, Todd says, hey, it was great to have you tonight. I'm looking forward to getting better acquainted with some of you tomorrow, so hopefully some of you can come to some of the other presentations. By the way, there's still some seats here. So if you enjoyed tonight and you want to come back for more tomorrow, you don't have to just listen to me because I'm going to show you pictures of mummies and other things, different things from anthropology. It'll be very fascinating. If it's not fascinating to you, the added bonus you'll get is you'll be able to sleep because we have to dim the lights, you know, to show the slides. But I think you'll find it very exciting and very practical as we learn lessons from ancient cultures. And then tomorrow night, improving blood fluidity, learning practical things that you can do to improve hemorheology. Even if you don't get all your money's worth, if it costs you several thousand dollars, you know, to change your schedule and come tomorrow night, even if you feel that wasn't worth it, just being able to tell your friends you learned about hemorheology, what is that worth? That'll surely impress them. Well, have a good night.